all of you kids like to see the show free? Huh? All right, then I want you all to get right here in the center and down within about 4 foot of the platform and stand there and don't move until I tell you, and I'm going to let you go in and see the show free. You hear me?
Hello, welcome to Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams. You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. This week's show, we're going to be looking really at American modernist literature and associated figures. So we've got some Ezra Pound, some E. Cummings, a bit of Gertrude Stein, and various other characters from that sort of period. And I start off there with a little bit of an excerpt of a record from the 50s, which is the Midway Carnival, recorded in New York. We'll just listen to a few more voices from that. That might give us a bit of an idea of the time and the general context and settings.
Now then, we're going to have the big fella to do something first. She did, you know, I want to do a trick or two for these nice folks. You do? Well, okay, that's fine. Now, I want you to show me how you kiss the girls, or do you do that, huh? That the way you do it? Do you ever hug the girls? Oh, boy, what a hug. Now, you sit down there a minute, and maybe I might have you do something else. I don't know. What do you think, huh? Well, okay, just a second. He wants to know if he can have a cigarette. Says he's just got to have a smoke. Well, I guess it'll be all right. Now, I suppose you want a match. Well, you take the box and the matches and go ahead and let's see what you can do about it, huh? Can you light it up by yourself? Hurry up, then. Come on, we're waiting on you. That's a boy. Now he's really got it, I bet, huh? Okay. Now, while this fella's having a little smoke here, I'd just like to tell you folks just a couple of things about these animals here. And then if you want to stand right where you are now for just 1 minute, we're going to have these two little fellas, this one and little Mickey and Tony over there, to put on those little boxing gloves and sort of give you a little sample of how they box. But before we do, I want to tell you that these animals are chimpanzees. They're not monkeys. They do belong to the monkey family, but they're much more intelligent than just ordinary monkeys are. Now, this is Mickey here. That's Cookie, and the other one is Tony. Tony and Mickey here are twin brothers, and they do all kinds of circus acts in there. They ride bicycles, they roller skate, they walk tight ropes, they wrestle, dance, juggle, box. But the funniest thing that they do is to box when they have their roller skates on. Now, this is old Cheetah here, the one that used to play in the movies, and I'm pretty sure you've seen him lots and lots of times. And if you ever laughed in your life, you'll positively laugh when you see that monkey trying to ride that billy goat in there. But our main animal is an animal we have inside in a big steel-bound circus wagon built purposely for just one big wild animal, and that is King Kong, the world's largest ape. Now, we got an ape in there, stands about this high, and weighs pretty near three times as much as a man. Now, we're going to feed that fella in just about 2 minutes in there. We're going to take these little fellas in because they start the show off, and I'm going to cut the price down to nothing. Now, our regular price to go here is 50 cents for grown people, 30 for children. But if you can get a ticket right there or right here, no ticket seller there, all right. If you get a ticket right here within the next 2 minutes, I'm going to cut the price clear down to 20 cents for the adults and just a nickel for the children for the first show. Now, that's positively for the first show. So if you want to go at all, be sure and come in right now for the first show. I heard you going. Come on, all you children, 5 cents. Let's go. Get tickets right over here and come in and see the animals, everybody. Now hurry a little bit. Come on, right quick. Everybody, let's go. Right on in. Right on in. Come on, everybody go. Children, 5 cents positively for the first show only. For the first show only. After that, after the first show, it'll be 30 cents for the children. Right now, for the first show, it's a nickel. Come on now, hurry. 5 cents if you hurry. Come on, quick. Get him quick. You got 2 more minutes. After that, the price goes up.
Now, see if you can keep the voice of that barker in your mind until the end of the show, because we're going to return to another snippet from the same record, which is an interview with either him or one of the other guys. But it does provide some sort of interesting background. Anyway, moving on, we're going to have a listen to some of Ezra Pound's Confucian Odes. Now, these were recorded when he was 85 about 1970. So, as well as the content, the voice, the qualities of the voice, I find absolutely fascinating. But see if you can get some sense out of this. Sometimes you might miss certain bits, but hopefully you'll pick up a lot.
Rats, stonehead rats, lay off our grain. 3 years' pain, enough helped us enough again. More than enough from you, dear few. We're about through and ready to go where something will grow on text. Good earth, good sown, and come into our own. Rats, big rats, lay off our wheat. 3 years deceit, and now we're about ready to go to lo quo. Happy, happy land, lo quo. Good earth, where we can earn our worth. Rats, stonehead rats, spare our new shoots. 3 years, no pay. We're about ready to move away to some decent border town. Good earth, good soul, make an end to this endless moan. Old Br'er Rabbit watching his feet. Rabbit nets cut the pheasant beat. When I was young in the starting life, I kept away from trouble and strife. But then, as life went on, did I meet trouble? Aye, my son, wish I could sleep till life was done. In fleecy coats with 5 white tassels, affable snakes, great Duke's vassals glide from his hall to tuck their court rations inside. In lambskin coats with 5 wider tassels, affable snakes, the Duke's vassals all glide out to dinner on leaving the hall. With quadruple tassels or seams to their coats, lambskin and all, with that elegant look, noble vassals, affable snakes glide out to consume what they get from the Duke.
Ezra Pound there reading his translations of the Confucian Odes. So we're going to move on to T.S. Eliot next, reading The Hollow Men. But before I play you the excerpt of him reading, I'd just like to read the back of a copy of The Four Quartets, in which he makes an interesting comment about the role of poets reading their own poems. It goes as follows. The recording of a poem read by its author is no more definitive an interpretation than a recording of a symphony conducted by the composer. The poem, if it is of any depth and complexity, will have meanings in it concealed from the author and should be capable of being read in many ways and with a variety of emotional emphases. A good poem, indeed, is one which even the most accomplished reading cannot exhaust. What the recording of a poem by its author can and should preserve is the way that poem sounded to the author when he had finished it. The disposition of lines on the page and the punctuation, which includes the absence of punctuation marks when they are omitted where the reader would expect them, can never give an exact notation of the author's metric. The chief value of the author's record, then, is as a guide to the rhythms. Another reader reciting the poem need not feel bound to reproduce these rhythms, but if he has studied the author's version, he can assure himself that he is departing from it deliberately and not from ignorance. So without further ado, T.S. Eliot reading The Hollow Men.
The Hollow Men. We are the Hollow Men. We are the stuffed men leaning together. Headpiece filled with straw, alas. Our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass, or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. Shape without form, shade without color, paralyzed force, gesture without motion. Those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom, remember us, if at all, not as lost, silent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. Eyes I dare not meet in dreams, in death's dream kingdom, these do not appear. There the eyes are sunlight on a broken column. There is a tree swinging, and voices are in the wind singing. more distant and more solemn than a fading star. Let me be no nearer in death's dream kingdom. Let me also wear such deliberate disguises, rat's coat, crow's skin, crossed staves, in a field, behaving as the wind behaves, no nearer. Not that final meeting in the twilight kingdom. This is the dead land. This is cactus land. Here the stone images are raised. Here they receive the supplication of a dead man's hand under the twinkle of a fading star. Is it like this in death's other kingdom? Waking alone at the hour when we are trembling with tenderness, lips that would kiss form prayers to broken stone. The eyes are not here, there are no eyes here in this valley of dying stars, in this hollow valley, this broken jaw of our lost kingdom. In this last of meeting places we grope together and avoid speech, gathered on this beach of the tumid river, sightless unless the eyes reappear as the perpetual star, multifoliate rose of death, twilight kingdom, the hope only of empty men. Here we go round the prickly pear, prickly pear, prickly pear. Here we go round the prickly pear at 5 o'clock in the morning. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow. For thine is the kingdom. Between the conception and the creation, between the emotion and the response, falls the shadow. Life is very long. Between the desire and the spasm, between the potency and the existence, between the essence and the descent, falls the shadow. For thine is the kingdom. For thine is life is, for thine is the. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper.
In 1952-3, E. Cummings, the poet, returned to Cambridge, Massachusetts to deliver a series of non-lectures. Here's a selection from non-lecture number 3.
For the benefit of any heretical members of my audience who do not regard manhood as a barbarous myth propagated by sinister powers, let me at this point cheerfully risk a pair of perhaps not boring anecdotes. Back in the days of dog eat dog, my first anecdote begins, there lived a playboy whose father could easily have owned the original Super Skyscraper Deluxe, a self-styled cathedral of commerce, endowed with every impetus to relaxation, not excluding ultra-elevators, which, on the laudable assumption that even machinery occasionally makes mistakes, were regularly tested. Testing an ultra elevator meant that its car was brought clean up, deprived of safety devices, and dropped. As the car hurtled downward, a column of air confined by the elevator shaft became more and more compressed until, assuming that nothing untoward happened, it broke the car's fall completely, or so I was told by somebody who should know. At any rate, young Mr. X was in the habit not only of attending these salubrious ceremonies, but of entering each about-to-be-dropped car and of dropping with it as far and as long as the laws of a pre-Einsteinian universe permitted. Eventually, of course, somebody who shouldn't know telephoned a newspaper, which sent a reporter, who, after scarcely believing his senses, asked the transcender of Adam, point blank, why he fell so often. Our playful protagonist shrugged his well-tailored shoulders. For fun, he said simply, adding in a strictly confidential undertone, and it's wonderful for a hangover. Here, I feel, we have the male American stance of my adolescence. Or, if you prefer, the adolescent American male stance of what some wit once nicknamed a lost generation, whereof, let me hastily append, the present speaker considers himself no worthy specimen. My point, however, isn't that many of us were even slightly heroic, and is that fewer of us declined a gamble. I don't think we enjoyed courting disaster. I do feel we liked being born. And now let me give you my second anecdote, which concerns, appropriately enough, not a single human being whose name I forget, but a millionary mishmash termed the public. Rather recently in New York City, an old college chum, whom I hadn't beheld for decades, appeared out of nowhere to tell me he was through with civilization. It seems that ever since Harvard, he'd been making, despite all sorts of panics and panaceas, big money as an advertising writer. And this remarkable feat unutterably depressed him. After profound meditation, he concluded that America, and the world which she increasingly dominated, couldn't really be as bad as she and it looked through an advertising writer's eyes. And he promptly determined to seek another view, a larger view, in fact, the largest view obtainable. Bent on obtaining this largest obtainable view of America and America's world, my logical ex-pal wangled an appointment with a sub-sub-editor of a magazine, if magazine it may be called, possessing the largest circulation on Earth. A periodical whose each emanation appears simultaneously in almost every existing human language. Our intrepid explorer then straightened his tie, took six deep breaths, cleared his throat, swam right up, presented his credentials, and was politely requested to sit down. He sat down. Now listen, the sub-sub-editor suggested. If you're thinking of working with us, you'd better know the three rules. And what, my friend cheerfully inquired, are the three rules? The three rules, explained his mentor, are first, 8 to 80. Second, anybody can do it. And third, makes you feel better. I don't quite understand, my friend confessed. Perfectly simple, his interlocutor assured him. Our first rule means that every article we publish must appeal to anybody, man, woman, or child, between the ages of 8 and 80 years. Is that clear? My friend said it was indeed clear. Second, his enlightener continued, every article we publish must convince any reader of the article that he or she could do whatever was done by the person about whom the article was written. Suppose, for instance, you were writing about Lindbergh, who had just flown the Atlantic Ocean for the first time in history, with nothing but unlimited nerve and a couple of chicken or ham wafers sandwiches. Do you follow me? I'm ahead of you, my friend. Remembering rule number 2, the sub-sub went on, you'd impress upon your readers' minds over and over again the fact that, after all, there wouldn't have been anything extraordinary about Lindbergh if he hadn't been just a human being like every single one of them. See? I see, said my friend grimly. Third, the master of ceremonies intoned, we'll imagine you're describing a record-breaking Chinese flood. Millions of poor, unfortunate men and women and little children and helpless babies drowning and drowned. Millions more perishing of slow starvation, suffering inconceivable, untold agonies, and so forth. Well, any reader of this article must feel definitely and distinctly better when she or he finishes the article than when he or she began it. Sounds a trifle difficult, my friend hazarded. Don't be silly, the oracle admonished. All you've got to do when you're through with your horrors is to close by saying, but thanks to an all-merciful providence, we Americans, with our high standard of living and our Christian ideals, will never be subjected to such inhuman conditions as long as the stars and stripes triumphantly float over one nation indivisible. With liberty and justice for all. Get me? I get you, said my disillusioned friend. Goodbye. So ends the second anecdote. You may believe it or not, as you wish. As far as I'm concerned, it's the unbelievable, but also unquestionable, self-portrait of a 101% pseudo-world, in which truth has become televisionary, in which goodness means not hurting people, and in which beauty is shopping. Just or unjust, how any species of authentic individualism could stem from such a collective quagmire, I don't know. but here are four lines of a poem which didn't. While you and I have lips and voices, which are for kissing and to sing with, who cares if some one-eyed son of a bitch invents an instrument to measure spring with?
E.E. Cummings, described in the sleeve notes to this particular record as intransigent a Yankee as Thoreau, Paris and Greenwich Village might, without much exaggeration, be thought his Walden. So, to stay in New England, we move swiftly on to Robert Frost reading a couple of his own poems.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Stopping by woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
Robert Frost reading The Road Not Taken and Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. We're going to move south now, and I want to play you a recording of William Faulkner reading his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, which he won in 1949, although this is a recording from 1954. Just to give a different idea of the different sort of voices, accents, dialects even. We're going to come back to Faulkner later on and to Cummings as well. I just want to give you a short sample of this very different voice from the South.
I feel that this award was not made to me as a man, but to my work, a life's work in the agony and sweat of the human spirit. Not for glory, and least of all for profit, but to create out of the materials of the human spirit something which did not exist before. So this award is only mine in trust. It will not be difficult to find a dedication for the money part of it commensurate with the purpose and significance of its origin. But I would like to do the same with the acclaim, too, by using this moment as a pinnacle from which I might be listened to by the young men and women already dedicated to the same anguish and travail, among whom is already that one who will someday stand here where I am standing. Our tragedy today is a general and universal physical fear, so long sustained by now that we can even bear it. There are no longer problems of the spirit. There is only the question, when will I be blown up? Because of this, the young man or woman writing today has forgotten the problems of the human heart in conflict with itself. Which alone can I make good writing, because only that is worth writing about, worth the agony and the sweat. He must learn them again. He must teach himself that the basis of all things is to be afraid, and teaching himself that, forget it forever, leaving no room in his workshop for anything but the old verities and truths of the heart, the old universal truth, lacking which any story is ephemeral and doomed, love and honor and pity and pride and compassion and sacrifice. Until he does so, he labors under a curse. He writes not of love, but of lust, of defeats in which nobody loses anything of value, of victories without hope, and most of all, without pity or compassion. His griefs grieve on no universal bones, leaving no scars. He writes not of the heart, but of the glands. Until he relearns these things, he will write as though he stood among and watched the end of man. I decline to accept the end of man. It is easy enough to say that man is immortal simply because he will endure, that when the last ding-dong of doom has clanged and faded from the last worthless rock hanging tideless in the last red and dying evening, that even then there will still be one more sound, that of his puny, inexhaustible voice still talking. I refuse to accept this. I believe that man will not merely endure, he will prevail. He is immortal, not because he alone among creatures has an inexhaustible voice, but because he has a soul, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance. The poet's, the writer's duty is to write about these things. It is his privilege to help man endure by lifting his heart, by reminding him of the courage and honor and hope and pride and compassion and pity and sacrifice which have been the glory of his past. The poet's voice need not merely be the record of man. It can be one of the props, the pillars to help him endure and prevail.
Well, there's quite a bit of combative spirit that you can hear hopefully through all of the voices that I've played you so far. I want to come back to E.E. Cummings and play something which is a little less overtly challenging and confrontational to the existing order, but has a beauty of its own. This is just one of his poems. This is from a different record. This is one of my favourites, and it's called One's Not Half Two.
One's not half two. It's two are halves of one, which halves reintegrating shall occur no death and any quantity, but than all numerable mosts the actual more. Minds ignorant of stern miraculous this every truth, beware of heartless them. Given the scalpel, they dissect a kiss, or sold the reason, they undream a dream. One is the song which fiends and angels sing, or murdering lies by mortals told make two. Let liars wilt, repaying life their loan. We, by a gift called dying born, must grow. Deep in dark least ourselves, remembering love only rides his year. All lose, whole find.
When I read Faulkner's As I Lay Dying for the first time, I remember being pretty challenged by the whole layout of the novel. Each chapter is written from the perspective of one of the characters, and one of the characters, Vardaman, has mental problems. So it's very, very challenging as a reader to get inside the mind of all the different characters, especially Vardaman. Now, Faulkner, again in 1954, recorded some excerpts from As I Lay Dying, and I guess it's really verges on the stream of consciousness, or it is stream of consciousness in certain passages. I'm going to play a couple of excerpts from him from here, the first being from the perspective of Ants, the second from Dahl, and then the last couple from Vardaman. I'm just going to run them all through because there's nothing like the rhythm and the southern tones to just build up the picture. I think interrupting it doesn't really do it any favours. So this is a reasonably long excerpt, and I shall just let it play. So please sit back and I hope you enjoy it.
Ants keeps on rubbing his knees. His overalls are faded. On one knee, a serge patch cut out of a pair of Sunday pants wore iron slick. No man mislikes it more than me, he says. A fellow's got to guess ahead now and then, I say. But come long and short, it won't be no harm done neither way. She'll want to get started right off, he says. It's far enough to Jefferson at best. But the road is good now, I say. It's fixing to rain tonight, too. His folks buries at New Hope, too, not 3 miles away. But it's just like him to marry a woman born a day's hard ride away and have her die on him. He looks out over the land, rubbing his knees. No man so mislikes it, he says. They'll get back in plenty of time, I say. I wouldn't worry none. It means $3, he says. Might be it won't be no need for them to rush back no way, I says. I hope it. She's a-going, he says. Her mind is set on it. It's a hard life on women for a fact, some women. I mind my mammy lived to be 70 and more. Worked every day, rain or shine. Never a sick day since her last chap was born, until one day she kind of looked around her. And then she went and taken that lace-trimmed nightgown she had had for 45 years and never wore out of the chest, and put it on and lay down on the bed, and pull the covers up and shut her eyes. You all will have to look out for Pa the best you can, she said. I'm tired. Ants rubs his hand on his knees. The Lord giveth, he says. We can hear Cash a-hammering and a-sawing beyond the corner. It's true. Never a truer breath was ever breathed. The Lord giveth, I say. That boy comes up the hill. He is carrying a fish nigh as long as he is. He slings it to the ground and grunts ha and spits over his shoulder just like a man, done nigh as long as he is. What's that, I say, a hog? Where did you get it? Down to the bridge, he says. He turns it over, the underside caked over with dust where it's wet, the eye coated over, humped under the dirt. Are you aiming to leave it laying there? Ant says. I aim to show it tomorrow, Vardaman says. He looks toward the door. We can hear the talking coming on the draft. Cash, too, knocking and hammering at the boards. There's company in there, he says. Just my folks, I say. They'd enjoy to see it, too. He says nothing, watching the door. Then he looks down at the fish laying in the dust. He turns it over with his foot and prods at the eye bump with his toe, gouging at it. Ants is looking out over the land. Vardaman looks at Ants's face, then at the door. He turns, going toward the corner of the house, when Ants called him without looking around. You clean that fish, Ants says. Vardaman stops. Why can't you, Adele, clean it, he says. You clean that fish, Ants says. Oh, Paul, Vardaman says. You clean it, Ants says. He don't look around. Vardaman comes back and picks up the fish. It slides out of his hand, smearing wet dirt onto him, and flops down, dirtying itself again, gap-mouthed, goggle-eyed, hiding into the dust like he was ashamed of being dead, like he was in a hurry to get back hit again. Vardaman cusses it. He cusses it like a grown man standing astraddle of it. Ants don't look around. Vardaman picks it up again. He goes on around the house, toting it in both arms like an armful of wood, it overlapping him at both ends, head and tail, darn nigh big as he is. Ant's wrist dangled out of his sleeves. I never seen him with a shirt on that looked like it was his in all my life. They all looked like Jewel might have given him his old ones. Not Jewel, though. He's long on, even if he is spending. Except for the lack of sweat. You could tell there ain't been nobody else's but Ant's that way without no mistake. His eyes looked like pieces of burnt-out cinder fixed in his face, looking out over the land. When the shadow touches the steps, he says, it's 5 o'clock. Just as I get up, Cora comes to the door and says it's time to go on. Ants reaches for his shoe. Now, Mr. Bundren, Cora says, don't you get up now. He puts his shoes on, stomping into them, like he does everything, like he is hoping all the time he really can't do it and can quit trying to. When we go up the hall, we can hear them clumping on the floor like they was iron shoes. He comes toward the door where she is, blinking his eyes, kind of looking ahead of himself before he sees, like he is hoping to find her setting up in a chair maybe, or maybe sweeping, and looks into the door in that surprised way like he looks in and finds her still in bed every time, and Duadell still fanning her with the fan. He stands there like he don't aim to move again or nothing else. Well, I reckon we better get on, Cora says. I got to feed the chickens. It's fixing to rain, too. Clouds don't lie. The cotton making every day and the Lord sends. That'll be something else for him. Cash is still trimming at the boards. If there's a thing we can do, Cora says. Ants will let us know, I say. Ants don't look at us. He looks around, blinking in that surprised way, like he had wore himself down, being surprised, and was even surprised at that. If Cash just works that careful on my barn. I told Anne it likely won't be no need, I say. I so hope it. Her mind is set on it, he says. I reckon she's bound to go. It comes to all of us, Cora says. Let the Lord comfort you. About that corn, I say. I tell him again I will help him if he gets into a tight with her sick and all. Like most folks around here, I done hope him so much already I can't quit now. I aim to get to it today, he says. Seems like I can't get my mind on nothing. Maybe she'll hold out till you're laid by, I say. If God wills it, he says. Let him comfort you, Cora says. If Cass just works that careful on my barn, he looks up as we pass. Don't reckon I'll get to you this week, he says. Take no rush, I say, whenever you get around to it. We get into the wagon. Cora sets the cake box on her lap. It's fixing to rain, show. I don't know what he'll do, Cora says. I just don't know. Poor aunts, I say. She kept him at work for 30-odd years. I reckon she is tired. And I reckon she'll be behind him for 30 years more, Kate says. Or if it ain't her, he'll get another one before cotton picking. I reckon Cash and Doll can get married now, Eula says. That poor boy, Cora says, that poor little tyke. What about Jewel, Kate says. He can too, Eula says. Huh, Kate says. I reckon he will. I reckon so. I reckon there's more gals than one around here that don't want to see Jewel tied down. Well, they don't need to worry. Why, Kate, Cora says. The wagon begins to rattle. The poor little tyke, Cora says. It's fixing to rain this night. Yes, sir. A rattling wagon is mighty dry weather for a bird sale. But that'll be cured. It will for a fact. She ought to take them cakes after she said she would, Kate says. Paul stands beside the bed. From behind his leg, Bardeman peers, with his round head and his eyes round, and his mouth begins to open. She looks at Paul. All her failing life appears to drain into her eyes, urgent, irremediable. It's Jewel she wants, Duedel says. Why, Addie, Paul says, him and Dahl went to make one more load. They thought there was time, that you would wait for them, and that $3 and all, he stoops, laying his hand on hers. For a while yet she looks at him without reproach, without anything at all, as if her eyes alone to listen to the irrevocable cessation of his voice. Then she raises herself, who has not moved in 10 days. Duedel leans down, trying to press her back. Ma, she says, Ma, she is looking out the window, at Cash stooping steadily at the board in the fading light, laboring on toward darkness and into it, as though the stroking of the saw illumined its own motion, board and saw engendered. You, Cash, she shouts, her voice harsh, strong and unimpaired. You, Cash. He looks up at the gaunt face framed by the window in the twilight. It is a composite picture of all time since he was a child. He drops the saw and lifts the board for her to see, watching the window in which her face has not moved. He drags a second plank into position and slants the two of them into their final juxtaposition, gesturing toward the one jet on the ground, shaping with his empty hand and pantomime the finished box. For a while she still looks down at him from the composite picture, neither with censure nor approbation. Then the face disappears. She lies back and turns her head without so much as glancing at Paul. She looks at Bardeman, her eyes, the life in them rushing suddenly upon them. The two flames glare up for a steady instant. Then they go out as though someone had lain down and blown upon them. Ma, Duedel says, Ma, leaning above the bed, her hands lifted a little, the fan still moving like it was for 10 days, she begins to keen. Her voice is strong, young, tremulous and clear, wrapped with its own timbre and volume, the fan still moving steadily up and down, whispering the useless air. Then she flings herself across Addie Bundren's knees, clutching her, shaking her with the furious strength of the young, before sprawling suddenly across the handful of rotten bone that Addie Bundren left, jarring the whole bed into a chattering sibilance of mattress shucks, her arms outflung and the fan in one hand still, beating with expiring breath into the quilt. From behind Paul's leg, Bardeman peers, his mouth full open and all color draining from his face into his mouth, as though he has by some means fleshed his own teeth in himself, sucking. He begins to move slowly backwards from the bed, his eyes round, his pale face fading into the dust like a piece of paper pasted on a failing wall, and so out the door. Paul leans above the bed in the twilight, his humped silhouette partaking of that owl-like quality of a wry-feathered, disgruntled outrage, within which lurks a wisdom too profound or too inert for even thought. Darn them boys, he says. Then I begin to run. I run toward the back and come to the edge of the porch and stop. Then I begin to cry. I can feel where the fish was in the dust. It is cut up into pieces of not fish now, not blood on my hands and overhauled. Then it wasn't so. It hadn't happened then. And now she is getting so far ahead I cannot catch her. The trees look like chickens when they ruffle out into the cool dust on the hot days. If I jump off the porch, I can be where the fish was, and it all cut up into nut fish now. I can hear the bed and her face in them, and I can feel the floor shake when he walks on it. That came and did it. That came and did it when she was all right, but he come and did it. That fat son of a bitch. I jump from the porch running. The top of the barn comes swooping up out of the twilight. If I jump, I can go through it like the pink lady in the circus, into the warm smelling, without having to wait. My hands grab at the bushes. Beneath my feet, the rocks and dirt go rumbling down. Then I can breathe again in the warm smelling. I enter the stall, trying to touch him, and then I can cry. Then I can vomit the crying. As soon as he gets through kicking, I can, and then I can cry. The crying can. He killed her. He killed her. The life in him runs under the skin, under my hand, running through the splotches, smelling up into my nose where the sickness is beginning to cry, vomiting the crying, and then I can breathe, vomiting it. It makes a lot of noise. I can smell the life running up from under my hands, up my arms, and then I can leave the stall. I cannot find it. In the dark, along the dust, the walls, I cannot find it. The crying makes a lot of noise. I wish it wouldn't make so much noise. Then I find it in the wagon shed, in the dust, and I run across the lot and into the road, the stick jouncing on my shoulder. They watch me as I run, beginning to jerk back, their eyes rolling, snorting, jerking back on the hitch ring. I strike. I can hear the stick strike, and I can see it hitting their heads, the breast yoke missing altogether sometimes as they rear and plunge, but I am glad. You killed my maw. The stick breaks, they're raring and snorting, their feet popping loud on the ground. Loud because it is going to rain, and the air is empty for the rain, but it is still long enough. I run this way and that as they rear and jerk at the hitch rein, striking. You killed her. I strike at them, striking. They wheeling in long lunges, the buggy wheeling on two wheels, and motionless like it is nailed to the ground, and the horses motionless like they are nailed by the hind feet to the center of a whirling plate. I run in the dust. I cannot see, running in the sucking dust where the buggy vanishes on tilted wheels. I strike, the stick hitting into the ground, bouncing, striking into the dust, and then into the air again, and the dust sucking on down the road faster than if a car was in it. And then I can cry, looking at the stick. It is broken down to my hand, not longer than stove wood that was a long stick. I throw it away and I can cry. It does not make so much noise now. The cow is standing in the barn door, chewing. When she sees me, she comes into the lot. She lows, her mouth full of flopping green, her tongue flopping. I ain't a-going to milk you. I ain't a-going to do nothing for them. I turn to her when I pass. When I turn, she is just behind me with her sweet, hot, hard breath. Didn't I tell you I wouldn't? She nudges me, snuffling. She moans deep inside, her mouth closed. I jerk my hand, cursing her like Jewel does. Get now. I stoop my hand to the ground and run at her. She jumps back and whirls away and stops watching me. She moans. She goes on to the path and stands there looking up the path. It is dark in the barn, warm, smelling, silent. I can cry quietly watching the top of the hill. Cash comes to the hill, limping where he fell off the church. He looks down at the spring, then up the road and back toward the barn. He comes down the path stiffly and looks at the broken hitch rein and at the dust in the road, and then up the road where the dust is gone. I hope they've got clean past told by now. I so hope it. Cash turns and limps up the path. Darn him. I showed him. Darn him. I'm not crying now. I'm not anything. Duodell comes to the hill and calls me. Vardaman? I'm not anything. I'm quiet. You, Vardaman? I can cry quiet now, feeling and hearing my tears. Then it won't. It hadn't happened then. It was a laying right there on the ground, and now she's getting ready to cook it. It is dark. I can hear wood, silence. I know them. But not living sound, not even him. It is as though the dog were resolving him out of his integrity into an unrelated scattering of components, snuffing and stamping, smelling of cool flesh and ammoniac hair, of illusion of a coordinated whole of spots, hide, and strong bones within which, detached and secret and familiar, and ears, different from my ears, I see him dissolve, legs, a rolling eye, gauze spotting like cold flames, and float upon the dark and fading solution, all one yet neither, all either yet none. I can see hearing call toward him, caressing, shaping his hard shape, fetlock, hips, shoulder, and head, smell and sound. I am not afraid. Cooked and ate. Cooked and ate. When they get it finished, they are going to put her in it. And then for a long time I couldn't say it. I saw the dog stand up and go whirling away, and I said, "Are you going to nail her up in it, Cash? Cash? Cash?" I got shut up in the crib. The new door was too heavy for me. It went shut. I couldn't breathe because the rat was breathing up all the air. I said, are you going to nail her up in a cache? Nail it? Nail it? Pa walks around. His shadow walks around, over cash going up and down above the saw at the bleeding plank. Judell said we will get some bananas. The train is behind the glass, red on the track. When it runs, the track shines on and off. Pa said flour and sugar and coffee cost so much. Because I'm a country boy, because boys in town, bicycles. Why do flour and sugar and coffee cost so much when he is a country boy? Wouldn't you rather have some bananas instead? Bananas are gone, eaten, gone. When it runs on the track, shines again. Why ain't I a town boy, Pa? I said, God made me. I did not said to God to make me in the country. If he can make the train, why can't he make them all in town? Because flour and sugar and coffee. Wouldn't you rather have bananas? He walks around. His shadow walks around. It was not her. I was there looking. I saw. I thought it was her, but it was not. It was not my mother. She went away when the other one lay down in her bed and drew the quilt up. She went away. Did she go as far as town? She went further than town. Did all those rabbits and possums go further than town? God made the rabbits and possums. He made the train. Why must he make a different place for them to go if she is just like the rabbit? Paul walks around. His shadow does. The saw sounds like it is asleep. And so if Cash nails the box up, she is not a rabbit. And so if she is not a rabbit, I couldn't breathe in the crib, and Cash is going to nail it up. And so if she lets him, it is not her. I know. I was there. I saw when it did not be her. I saw. They think it is, and Cash is going to nail it up. It was not her because it was laying right yonder in the dirt, and now it's all chopped up. I chopped it up. It's laying in the kitchen in the beating pan, waiting to be cooked and ate. Then it wasn't, and she was, and now it is, and she wasn't. And tomorrow it would be cooked and ate, and she would be him and Pa and Cash and Duedel, and there won't be anything in the box, and so she can breathe. It was laying right yonder on the ground. I can get Vernon. He was there, and he's seen it. With both of us it would be, and then it will not be.
Now that rather long series of excerpts was William Faulkner reading from As I Lay Dying. Now we should go back to 1934-35 to hear what Johnny Trunk would call the bonkers Gertrude Stein reading her Portrait of Picasso.
If I told him a completed portrait of Picasso, if I told him, would he like it? Would he like it if I told him? Would he like it? Would Napoleon like it? If Napoleon, would he like it if I told him? If I told him, would he like it? Would he like it if I told him? Now, not now, and now. Now, exactly as kings. Feeling full for it. Exactitude as kings. So to beseech you as full as for it. Exactly or as kings. Shutters shut and open, so do queens. Shutters shut and shutters, and so shutters shut and shutters, and so shutters. And so shutters shut, and so shutters shut, and shutters, and so. And so shutters shut, and so, and also, and also, and so, and so, and also. Exact resemblance to exact resemblance, the exact resemblance, as exact as a resemblance. Exactly as resembling, exactly in resemblance, exactly a resemblance, exactly and resemblance. For this is so, because. Now actively repeat it all. Have, hold, and hear, actively repeat it all. I judge, as a resemblance to him. Who comes first? Napoleon the first. Who comes to? Coming to. Who goes there? As they go, they share. Who shares all? All is as all, as yet, or as yet. Now to date, now and date and the date. Who came first? Napoleon at first. Who came first? Napoleon the first. Who came first? Napoleon first. Presently. Exactly do they do, first exactly. Exactly do they do too, first exactly, and first exactly. Exactly do they do, and first exactly, and exactly. And do they do, at first exactly, and do they do, the first exactly. And do they do, the first exactly, at first exactly, first as exactly, at first as exactly, presently, as presently. He, and he, and he. And he, and as he, and as he, and he. He is, and as he is, and as he is, and he is, He is and as he and he and as he is and he and he and he and he. Can curls rob, can curls quote quotable, as presently, as exactitude, as trains, as trains presently, proportions as presently, father and father, was the king or room, father and weather, was there, what was there, what was there, was there, weather and in there, as even say so, one I land, two I land, three the land, three the land, three the land, two I land, one I land, two I land, as a so, they cannot, a note, they cannot, a float, they cannot, they dote, they cannot, they as denote, miracles play, play fairly well, a well, as or as presently. Let me recite what history teaches.
That was Gertrude Stein reading her Portrait of Picasso. You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. I'm Sean Williams, and this show has been Voice on Record. Next week, we're going to be having a show really about thinkers, so be prepared to listen to the mellifluous tones of Aldous Huxley, Buckminster Fuller, Krishnamurti, who else have we got? Marshall McLuhan, several others. You can get a full track listing and other information of the show on www.sbkw.net/voiceonrecord. That's sbkw.net/voiceonrecord. And you can email me at voiceonrecord@sbkw.net. So just remaining to play you the what I promised earlier on, which was interviews with one of the Barkers and some of the other circus and carnival hands from the Midway Carnival, recorded in the 50s. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and keep listening to Resonance 104.4 FM.
A sideshow is a funny show to operate. We have to be on our toes at all times and just hope that we'll run into something new. I'll tell you about a two-headed boy that's right now in the state of New York. The boy is bright-minded. He's a quick-thinking child. Got intelligent faces on both heads and intelligent eyes. And I believe that that child is so much better off out in the show business, earning his living and making money. And a boy like him can make enough money to where when he got up in years, he'd be independently wealthy. He'd have nothing to worry about. He'd be out in the world, he'd see people. People would see him. He would become accustomed to the fact that he did have two heads. And they're just so much better off, I believe, being out where they can see something than they are laying in a room in a hospital bed all their life.
I've been a funhouse operator now for going on 20 years. Altogether, I've been in show business 42 years, all told. I started when I was 11 years old, working in a high wire act. The act was finally broken up when I went from working a high wire act to an animal trainer. For several years, I worked as a lion trainer. From there, I went to handling large snakes. Getting away from animals, I decided to branch back into a funhouse operation, which had no dealing with animals of any kind, but was still a means of staying in show business, which is my first love.
I'm what the general public could call a barker, but among the show people, it's a talker. Perhaps you notice in my speech, I have a little impediment in my speech. Well, I've stammered ever since I can remember, but when I stand up on my belly to talk to the people, to tell them about the show inside, it's a peculiar thing. The stammer all disappears, and I don't stammer anymore. And how that come about, I don't know. In other words, this is my 43rd year in show business and enjoy it very much, watch every inch of it, and it looks as though that I'll spend the rest of my days in show business.